Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as usual, what's become a regular feature here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast is question answering time, where I call upon my colleague, Layla Mutin from the Hoffman Center. She's the nutritionist, she's a registered dietitian, and she also has a master's degree in the field of nutrition, and we work together helping patients at the Hoffman Center, and I can think of no one better suited than Layla to help us field some of our listener questions. So how are you doing today, Layla?
I'm terrific. How are you, Dr. Hoffman?
Very well, thanks.
And, wonderful.
We just got done putting out one of our newsletters. What did you talk about in the newsletter again?
I talked about that it's not just about calcium for our bone, but calcium for the prevention of osteoporosis.
Okay, that actually touches upon one of the questions that I'm going to pose during today's podcast, because somebody asked about that. So it's not, calcium's not the sum total of, we used to think that's the end-all and be-all, and you wrote a very nice article to the effect that there are other things involved. And I wrote an article with a curious title of Hunger is My Friend. And the actual title of the article was Repeat After Me, Hunger is My Friend. And so you're going to have to subscribe to the newsletter via radio program at AOL.com. Just send us an email to radioprogram@AOL.com to find out what that cryptic title means. Hunger is my friend. I thought hunger is a bad thing. According to my blog in this week's newsletter, au contraire. Okay, you can find out what it's about, radioprogram@AOL.com. Just ask for a subscription. And let me share with you, Layla, some nice feedback we're getting on these Intelligent Medicine podcasts. This one comes to us from Denise, who writes, thank you for the Intelligent Medicine podcast. They are fantastic, with a capital F.
Yay!
She says, I listen while I am working in our apple peach orchard.
That's wonderful.
Although it is hard work, it is a fabulous life. Of course, staying in the know with your podcast makes the day just breeze by. So we can visualize Denise laboring away in the – this is apple picking season, right?
Yes.
It's fall. So she's picking the apples and she's
– having fun in the orchard. How wonderful.
Getting sunshine, fresh air, and listening to the – I wonder if she has it on loudspeaker. So how do you – with the wind blowing and outside,
Well, maybe she has it on her iPod or something.
Yeah, she probably has headphones. And, okay, so fine. And then this is an interesting one. We got one from Eric, who says, Dear Dr. Hoffman, with two N's. That's a little bit of a tip-off, because it's H-O-F-M-A-N-N. And that's the German spelling of my name. Actually, my father, who was from Germany, he came here in the 1930s, and then he served in the U.S. Army. And being a German in the 1940s was not a cool thing. So he had to he had to get rid of his accent, and he changed the spelling of the name. He Americanized it. But the point is,
did he actually get rid of his accent?
He did a really good job of getting.
Wow.
You ever hear Kissinger speak?
Yes.
He has a very heavy German accent. He came around the same time my father came. He has a very heavy accent. My father managed to almost completely overcome his German accent, even though he came as a young man. So anyway, this guy's from Germany. Eric is from Germany, and he writes, I am grateful for your Intelligent Medicine podcast. I follow it with TuneIn on my iPhone here in Stuttgart, Germany. I'm a Qigong instructor, Reiki master, massage therapist, translator, and I'm finishing my studies as a TCM therapist and allopathic doctor. Those Germans are amazing. I mean, first of all, there's not a single grammatical error here. This guy's English is perfect. It's amazing. Regarding nutrition, but he has a question, so let's see what his question is. Regarding nutrition, some of my enlightened teachers here praise Dr. T. Colin Campbell's New York Times bestseller, China Study, in defense of a vegan diet. Yet your recent episodes and guests espouse the virtues of the paleo low-carb diet with equal logic. How can I reconcile these opposite dietary philosophies? I'm confused. Regards, Eric. So what can we say, Layla, to Eric, who is talking about the, quote, China study by T. Colin Campbell.
Well, Eric is very, very well read, as we can garner from that email. He needs to look at the flaws in the methodology of the cherry-picked China study. So that would be the first order of business for Eric to do if he has time with all of his studies.
So that's an interesting image you used, because, you know, we just talked to the apple picker and peach picker, and you're talking about cherry picking. What is from the standpoint of science?
From the apple picked research.
From the standpoint of science, what does that mean? Because we, you know, among ourselves, we talk about research that is cherry picked.
Yes.
But what does that mean to, you know, for the general public?
There is a lot, reams and reams and reams of scientific research about everything. That doesn't mean all of it is correct. We, if we're worthy of our credentials, have to go through that research. We have to scrutinize it very, very well. We have to look at to find any flaws in methodology. We have to determine if it's valid, if it's replicable, all of that. Anyway, a lot of published research is very, very flawed, and what I'm saying is a lot of that research is up to be picked out to make any kind of point that you want in a book, in science, anywhere, any kind of medium.
They say
so,
that
the devil
can quote scriptures to his own purpose. That's
actually
a biblical saying, I think.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
So anybody would need to look at and scrutinize the scientific research and find out
right.
if
so
it's
here's,
valid.
Here's my comment on the China study. And actually, I put that in quotation marks, the China study, because it is actually not a study. It sounds very scientific, and he's a PhD, and he, you know, looked at a lot of stuff going on in China. But it's actually not really a study. It's a series of accounts of how disease prevalence was less in China 50, 60 years ago, perhaps up to 40 years ago. Now, if we look at what China was 40, 50, 60 years ago, first of all, people were starving for the most part. And yes, they were on a diet where there was less meat because they just couldn't afford meat. But also, they had a very high level of physical activity, and their calories were overall limited. Colin Campbell's contention is that the problem began when they introduced meat into the Chinese diet. And I would maintain that a lot of things have changed. Yes, they got more prosperous. They introduced more meat. They had more labor-saving devices, cars, and so on. And what then happened is we saw an increase in certain degenerative diseases, particularly cancer and cardiovascular disease. And in addition, the Chinese have really mucked up their environment with a lot of terrible environmental pollution. It, you know, makes, you know, L.A. smog look like, you know, a beautiful spring day.
A lot of mercury, yeah.
Yeah, spring day in the, you know, in Yosemite Forest, you know. There's just a lot of junk in the air. There's a lot of junk in the water. It's a free fire zone when it comes to environmental pollution. And I think they've really increased their risk of particularly cancer as a result. So my most, I think, cogent rebuttal to the China study is they just did a study of the Chinese and Asian diets. And what they discovered is, of course, you know, there is more meat in those diets. But the increase in meat, just the meat per se, if they just look at meat as a single thing, that is not associated with a higher risk of either cancer or cardiovascular disease.
Mm-hmm.
So, other elements, maybe overall calories, overall fat, poor quality oils, too much sugar, and boy, they just love Western food over there. I mean, they got a lot of fast food eateries. KFC is really popular there, Kentucky Fried Chicken. And that's the problem, not meat per se, or particularly, you know, high quality, grass-fed beef and organic poultry and, fish that's not laden with mercury. That, in my opinion, is not the problem there. It's just overall caloric intake, sedentary lifestyle, pollution. And so what they're mistaking correlation for causation. They're seeing like, okay, yeah, they're eating more meat and that's the problem. Well, no, there's a lot of
stuff. What you said is so very important. They're mistaking correlation for causation. Exactly, precisely. And that's the flaw, that the associations that people are making, they don't withstand any kind of test or scrutiny or anything like that. That's the difference between correlation and causation. You know, just because you can make any analogy using correlation that has nothing to do with anything else. So no, that's a very, very important point.
Right. So I would say to Eric, you know, and look, I leave room, and you do too, in working with patients. There's not a one-size-fits-all diet. Mm-hmm. There's some patients who do very well on relatively low-protein, high vegetable diets with mm-hmm. you know, moderately high amounts of good quality carbohydrates. I mean, low glycemic index, high fiber, slow-release carbohydrates. That could work for some people. Some people can tolerate wheat. Some people can tolerate dairy. But in general, what we're finding is people consume, it's not about too much animal protein, it's really about too much carbohydrates. So that's, I mean, I think we're on the same page on that.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So do you have any questions that came your way?
Actually, yes. This comes from Nina. She says, as a long time and devoted listener to the program, I've heard Dr. Hoffman recommend taking strontium at bedtime on an empty stomach. What constitutes an empty stomach? In other words, how long would one wait before taking strontium? She also adds, would it be as effective if taken first thing in the morning on an empty stomach?
Okay.
And that's Nina, yes.
So what's your take on that?
Well, strontium, the point of taking it on pretty much an empty stomach, it can be more bioavailable that way. However, the more important thing with strontium that we find is that you take it away from any calcium. So at least a few hours, at the very least 2 hours away from calcium. And yes, 2 hours after a meal would constitute an empty stomach, and you could also take it first thing in the morning on an empty stomach. That works for a lot of our patients as well, who have trouble taking things at night and who would rather take, and then they balance their calcium supplement accordingly throughout the day away from strontium.
Okay, and I totally agree. One point I will make is that people get a little nutsy sometimes when we make these recommendations. We say, take this away from food, and they go, oh my goodness, you know, if I had like a, you know, tiny, like I had a couple of grapes, you know, within an hour of it, is that going to completely neutralize the effect? And what we're talking about, first of all, a lot of things in nutrition have not been completely settled or fully resolved. So the strontium story is evolving. And as a precaution, we say keep it away, particularly from calcium, because calcium may antagonize the strontium. It may compete for absorption. So probably not a great idea to wash your strontium down with a glass of milk. Or, you know, I've seen some supplements that irrationally combine strontium with other bone-building nutrients, including calcium. And I think those supplements are a bad idea because the calcium in the supplement that's combined with the strontium is going to neutralize possibly the effects of the strontium. Although we're not entirely sure. This is not rocket science yet. This is not a moon launch.
Yeah, nutrition is such a brand new science if you look at all of our evolution. So we're just keeping up with everything we're finding out as we go. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else on your docket?
Yes, we have from Heidi. Hello, Dr. Hoffman. This morning you spoke about strontium as an excellent supplement against bone loss. Before hearing this, I purchased a bone food powder. Would it be okay to use strontium as well? And she goes on to talk about what's in the powder, like D, silica, boron, vitamin K, calcium. Yeah, as a matter of fact, yes, but because it contains calcium, as we were just saying, you take the strontium away from this particular bone food powder supplement. So that would be fine.
Okay. And while we're at it, let's talk about some of the, you know, earlier we had this question about calcium.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what's the deal? Well, you know, in your column, you talked about calcium is not the be-all and end-all of bone. I mean, that's sort of like a 1980s thing. We used to think, oh, you know, take a lot of calcium, and then you had these commercials, you know, take Tums, and people were taking they're just taking, you know, eating Tums all day long, hoping that was going to go right to their bones, and their bones were going to get strong. And what could be the problem with that?
Yeah, well, and this also relates to a question from Diane. She says, in a recent Intelligent Medicine column, Layla mentioned that getting calcium through dairy is not the best way. If supplements are fraught with danger, she says, then how in the world are we supposed to get enough calcium? She also adds, I'm prone to leg cramps. So related to exercise. Well, the leg cramps could be another reason, like not enough magnesium, but let's come back to the calcium question. We get a lot of calcium from our food. If we eat almonds, broccoli, dark green leafies, if you're making soup or stock from scratch, where you take the leftover of that roast chicken you had for dinner and you put it in some water with some vegetables and you simmer it, you're getting calcium also.
That's bone. I mean, that's literally bone. You know.
It's literally, exactly.
Because that's what I do. Sometimes I'll eat the chicken, I'll take the carcass, I'll just make a stock from it.
Make a stock.
And you're getting some calcium in that. We call that bone broth.
Yes, yes. And you could even enhance that a little further if you add like a teaspoon to a tablespoon of white vinegar, and it can enhance the leaching of that calcium.
It actually will dissolve the calcium and make it more soluble and go into the solution.
Yeah. Also, it's a complete, as I was saying in this week's Intelligent Medicine column, this is a complete oversimplification in nutrition. We don't make the house stronger by adding more siding to it. It's not all about the calcium. It's also dependent on other nutrients, vitamin K, vitamin D, magnesium, the electrolytes, omega-3s, all of that. And nobody's supposed to be taking 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams of calcium anymore. We're finding especially that there's all this calcium we've been taking since the 1980s without any added magnesium could be a risk factor for kidney stones, for one thing.
And then there's the controversy, and I say controversy because it hasn't really been resolved. I think when she's saying the danger of supplements, I think she's talking about the potential danger of too much in the way of calcium supplements. Yes, kidney stones. But also, I mean, actually some studies exonerate calcium at moderate doses for kidney stones, so we can't say that everyone who has kidney stones shouldn't be taking any calcium whatsoever. But there is some concern that too much calcium will go into your arteries and cause plaque, and some studies have suggested that, although more recently there have been some studies that say, no, that's not a big problem at the moderate doses that we're suggesting, you know, maybe 800 or 1,000 or maybe even 1,200 milligrams of additional calcium.
So there is that. Now, Diane says also, I'm prone to leg cramps.
Yes.
Related to exercise. I think that's more about magnesium, don't you?
Yeah, and there is also this theory that if you just take calcium to the exclusion of magnesium, you may create an imbalance. So possibly, you know, patients who have a condition called hyperparathyroidism, they may have too much calcium and not enough magnesium. It's sort of they're on a seesaw. And taking more magnesium, and in fact taking more vitamin D, can help to rectify that. So, you know, I'm going to read in, I guess, next another question about leg cramps. Because leg cramps, a lot of people think, oh, you know, just take magnesium and you'll be fine. That isn't always the case. Although I have to say magnesium is great for many cases of leg cramps. Let me read this question here. This one comes to us from Michael. Greetings. I would like Dr. Oppen to address this question on one of his podcasts. Lately, I've been experiencing severe leg cramps from the calf down, spasms and pain in the middle of the night. I take a wide range of supplements, including much magnesium. Please advise. So my take on that is...
question is, what form of magnesium
yes,
is he taking?
Thank you. So why don't you address that? Because there's some magnesiums that are, frankly, not that well absorbed.
Exactly. For instance, magnesium citrate and magnesium oxide are not very bioavailable. They are actually used more for softening stool.
Yeah, and they work great for that. Yeah.
They do. They work great for that. So that magnesium, the oxide form, the citrate form, may not be readily absorbed. So if Michael is taking a lot of magnesium citrate or magnesium oxide, that's not going to work well. Although I hope his bowels are functioning very well taking that much magnesium.
Yeah.
But the more bioavailable ones are malate, glycinate. Taurate is another one, but between malate and glycinate, those are wonderful.
And the product we use, and by the way, drhoffman.com, we have a store and a lot of the things that we talk about here on Intelligent Medicine Podcasts, these things are available there, so please check it out. And, you know, that's another way that you can indirectly subsidize these podcasts and the newsletter and all the information that we send out, which is free. We use something called Jigsaw Magnesium. And so tell us about Jigsaw Magnesium.
Jigsaw Magnesium is actually magnesium malate, and because so many forms of magnesium tend to create a stool softening effect, this particular form does not. I believe the Jigsaw brand's advertising campaign is actually based on it won't make you go to the bathroom.
In fact, they part of one of the promotions, if you go to their booth at a like a trade fair, they hand out complimentary rolls of toilet paper.
Yeah.
Each of which has a monogram of the logo of Jigsaw Magnesium to remind you that, no, this isn't going to make you go to the bathroom more.
Right. So Michael should check out what kind of magnesium he's taking and then switch it accordingly.
Right. Okay, so that's number one. But I got to say that magnesium is not a one-stop shop, and for a couple reasons. One is that there's some people, no matter how much magnesium they take orally, they just do not reach magnesium homeostasis. Now, that just doesn't make sense to some people, because seemingly, you know, if you want to fill a glass, you just pour more water in it and it fills up eventually, right?
Mm.
But the body is different. Metabolism is highly regulated. So, for example, you could take, you know, pounds of calcium, you know, just like take it in bulk, and your calcium is highly regulated. It's going to usually be somewhere between 9.0 and 10.4 is in terms of your blood
mm-hmm.
test. It's just regulated. Similarly, magnesium is regulated, and there are some people who are just challenged in terms of their ability to maintain magnesium. Often these people they can be sick, they can have problems with their kidneys, or sometimes they're just highly stressed individuals. We see people who have this condition, mitral valve prolapse, which is a heart, it's just a variation on the theme with a heart, not usually very dangerous, but sometimes they are very stressed, they're prone to muscle spasms, and it's very hard to get their magnesium up. Patients with chronic fatigue syndrome often have low magnesium. We can't get their magnesium up with oral magnesium. So we actually have to make use of something called a Myers cocktail. We give intravenous magnesium, and that actually is what's necessary for some people to get their magnesium into normal range. It's just a problem. They're magnesium challenged.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Michael, this stuff happens always at night. And sometimes things happen at night because, you know, you're at rest and they're more noticeable. But when you have muscle spasms at night, sometimes what this is related to, it could be related to low blood sugar, of course, right? You know, that's
mm-hmm.
a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also be related to just, it's positional. Sometimes, you know, when you sleep and you cross your legs and, you know, you get a little older and you have little osteophytes on your vertebrae and your back, you know, which pinch the nerves. Sometimes this causes, you know, your arm falls asleep or your leg falls asleep, or potentially you might have spasms because the nerve impulses are cut off. And that can cause a muscle to spasm. So, you know, I would investigate, you know, even a chiropractor might address that concern. And, you know, there are actually some studies that pregnant women get a lot of muscle cramps. It's actually been shown that for them, B vitamins seem to make a difference.
Yeah.
A good B complex can actually help pregnant women's muscle cramps. For some reason, I'm not exactly sure how the B vitamins work to help muscle spasm, but they do.
Interesting. I would imagine with pregnancy, just the burden of the load could cut off circulation.
Yeah, absolutely.
That certainly wouldn't help either, but
yep.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, pregnant women get a lot of back problems and you know, so on. Okay, this one comes to us from Rona. Rona writes, I did live in New York and listen to Dr. Hoffman. Now that I live in Florida, I can hear him through my iPad or computer on Saturday from noon to 2 when he's on. I do have a question that maybe he could address. My husband has been given a diagnosis of Grover's disease. It's an annoying itchy rash that appears on his chest and won't go away. Though a dermatologist has prescribed various corticosteroid creams that have really not helped very much. Are there any natural approaches to this? Would aloe vera help at all? Does diet affect this? And she writes parenthetically, Dr. Hoffman has helped me personally with osteoporosis, and I believe in him wholeheartedly. Thanks, Rona. Okay, so here's the deal with Grover's disease. This is a medical condition that mostly affects men who are a little past middle age, you know, 60s, 70s. You know, that's really the target group for Grover's disease. And you get these little spots, like little red spots, and they're actually not crusty, they're under the skin, and they're very itchy and uncomfortable. and they don't really respond well to steroid creams. However, studies show that higher doses of vitamin A help Grover's disease. So actually, it's not the beta-carotene form, it's the retinol form of vitamin A, and I would recommend that he take maybe 25,000 international units of vitamin A. You have to be careful with that vitamin A, because at high doses, that vitamin A can affect the liver. So if you're going to go high, you know, 50 or 100,000, I mean, it can be used, but you have to do this, I think, under a doctor's supervision. You know, vitamin A is great for certain skin conditions. It's good for acne, also psoriasis, but it is toxic at high doses, we know, and it's not something that pregnant women should be taking at high doses. I also have a case of Grover's disease where the vitamin A didn't, you know, it did a little bit, but it didn't make it go away. And then I gave the guy low-dose naltrexone, which is it's actually medication. It's a special formulation that we compound of a standard medication. It's good for autoimmune conditions. We use it for Crohn's disease. We use it for multiple sclerosis. And it seems to, he just swore by it. He said, man, you really fixed me. I mean, my itching went down to nothing. It seems to work on opiate receptors in the brain and maybe in the nerves. And Grover's disease, and, you know, it's an itchy condition. Maybe that has something to do with calming down the itchiness. The opiate receptors aren't functioning properly to reduce the skin discomfort. And it's not like this is a low-dose naltrexone is not it's not a pain reliever. It's not a opium-like drug or an addictive drug. It's just something that kind of resets the body's own internal endogenous morphine system. You know, these, the so-called, you know, the runner's high, endorphins. And by rejiggering your endorphins, it sometimes helps itchy conditions. It's worth a try. It's, you know, it's not expensive. It must be prescribed by a knowledgeable doctor. I think it's just an example of an ingenious use of something that, you know, low toxicity, low expense, worth a try, and could make a difference. So, you know,
low-dose naltrexone, we've been so successful with so many of our autoimmune patients with LDN. It's really wonderful.
Yeah, and more information, you can go to LDNinfo.org, or I think that's the website. And there's even an article that I wrote on it on the Internet for multiple sclerosis. So so that's the deal for Grover's. I think there are some things that can be done. Any more in your mail basket?
I actually have a question. I have this too. I would like to, this comes from Roz.
You're not going to ask for a raise on the air, are you? We'll take care of that in the office.
Thank you. Okay. But thanks for reminding me. No,
okay.
Kidding. This comes from Roz.
Yeah.
I would like to ask you what to do about my high sensitivity C-reactive protein.
Oh, I have it right in front of me. Yes.
Yeah, a 5. She says without taking medication.
Okay, sure. Okay, so what don't you do the honors? Why don't you explain what that high-sensitivity CRP is?
Yeah, C-reactive protein is a marker of inflammation, but high-sensitivity, or HSCRP, is a marker of possibly a cardiac risk factor, inflammation in the arteries. And Roz has an HSCRP of 5.
Okay.
The first thing I would want to know
let's give their normal range for that.
A normal range would be less than 1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would
we
be
would
optimal.
Like to see it less than 1.
Right. I mean,
optimally, but
conventional medicine says less than 2. I would like to see it less than 1.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what happens is, frankly, as you age, your inflammatory markers tend to go up. At least in the West, you know, probably not the case for, you know, Paleolithic man who lived in healthy circumstances, exercised, ate a great diet. There is a tendency for it to go up. And some people consider this a more important marker of risk for cardiovascular disease than even cholesterol or even HDL, triglycerides, that this is really where the rubber meets the road when it comes to cardiovascular risk. Because you can have a high cholesterol, but if you have a low HSCRP, then you're much less likely to get cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. Well, as we're finding out that so many of our chronic diseases begin with inflammation, a high cholesterol doesn't necessarily mean inflammation, does it?
Right.
But a high C-reactive protein does. I would like to know, first off, if Roz is overweight or insulin resistant.
Bingo.
Insulin resistance, high blood sugars can drive up CRP, even HSCRP.
Just body fat will do it.
Just having body fat will.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Other things to quash inflammation, Dr. Hoffman, besides, you know, nice amounts of fish oil, EPA, DHA, maybe things such as, first of all, weight loss has to happen if she is overweight, if she is insulin resistant. But if all those things are taken care of, more anti-inflammatories, maybe boswellia, maybe curcumin, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you think allergies would affect an hsCRP?
Definitely. I think that could be part of, look, there, in our conception of allergies, as you know, there are allergies which are the obvious ones. Like people say, you know, every time I eat a raw peach, my mouth swells up, or, you know, every time I have dairy, I start sneezing, I get congested. Okay, so that's an obvious thing. But then there are these sort of slowly developing insidious allergies. Not really allergies, they're more like food intolerances. We pick them up with the IgG RAS test. These are things that sort of slowly raise the flame on your immune system, and then the immune system gets overactive and you develop inflammatory problems throughout your body. It might be arthritis, it might be muscle pain, muscle aches, fatigue, it might be higher risk of cardiovascular disease or Alzheimer's disease. And I think by pulling out those foods that are the culprits, and they're different foods for different people, the CRP goes down. So definitely. Then there's this notion, as you know, Layla, of the pro-inflammatory foods and anti-inflammatory foods. So talk to us about that.
Oh, pro-inflammatory foods, certainly sugar, factory-made trans fats, things of that nature. Other pro-inflammatory foods could be high omega-6 vegetable oils. You know, the things that are supposedly touted as healthy, they're actually not.
Like the salad dressings, they have
salad
like
dressings,
the
exactly.
Cottonseed oil, and they have lots
cotton
of...
Cottonseed is probably one of the worst,
oil.
But
yeah.
Peanut oil, soybean oil, safflower, sunflower, all are very, very pro-inflammatory. And we're getting too much of that in the American diet. So everybody's walking around with a little bit of inflammation if they're eating this way. And certainly if they're eating a lot of grains, that's another source of a lot of omega-6 fats.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And, I mean, in general, you know, the foods that are junk foods, that are bereft of natural nutrients, are pro-inflammatory. I mean, I can't think of a more pro-inflammatory diet than, you know, in the fast food places. And the anti-inflammatory things are generally things that are, you know, the technicolor foods that, have the signature of bright colors, which has the connotation that they contain helpful compounds that, you know, the polyphenols that are present in things like tea and chocolate and wine and even beer and spices. These are wonderful anti-inflammatory nutrients that we should make sure we get plenty of.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Blueberries.
Rainbow of colors every day. Yep.
Blueberries. Absolutely. You know, things like mm-hmm. that. So so those are some things. Also, I would add, there's actually some studies that show that magnesium alone will lower C-reactive protein. Those are of interest. And then there's one study that I found interesting showing that if you just take a multivitamin, and it has like a variety, like a whole smorgasbord of nutrients in it, it's unclear which nutrient is most responsible for this, but people who take multivitamins have lower C-reactive protein. So, from conventional medicine standpoint, what they want to do for high C-reactive proteins, they want to either give you aspirin, which does work to reduce inflammation, but it also creates a lot of problems. It can increase the risk of bleeding. It can increase the risk of leaky gut, ulceration.
Can I bring up a pet peeve of mine?
Sure.
We have so many patients. Some of them are taking aspirin either on their own or as recommended by their doctors or cardiologists. And
right.
Then I go to find out that they're taking that aspirin on an empty stomach.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate because their doctor is telling them to take that aspirin at night.
Oh boy.
And we can't take aspirin on an ulcer or a GI bleed down the road. We want to take, I tell everybody, you must take that aspirin on a full stomach. So I wish doctors would stop giving that advice.
Right.
Take it at night. Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
Then, you know, of course, there's actually, with this highly sensitive C-reactive protein, they did this big study called the Jupiter study. And that study suggested that there are probably about another 20 or 30 million Americans who could benefit from statins, even people who do not have high cholesterol, who have highly sensitive C-reactive proteins, and their cutoff was 2, that statin drugs will lower C-reactive protein.
Well, that's just terrible.
And you know, my answer is, we just, in the past, 10 minutes, enumerated all the different natural ways to lower C-reactive protein. Why put so many tens of millions of Americans at risk by putting them on statin drugs to fix a problem which can be fixed naturally? And the answer is, of course, it's a profit-driven system. And if you've got a new way to sell more statin drugs to people who have great cholesterols, I mean, these are people who have normal cholesterols. They want to extend the prescribing of statins, because statins actually probably work not just by suppressing cholesterol. They work by, they have an anti-inflammatory effect. That's called a pleiotropic or off-target effect of the statins that is probably why they offer some protection to people who've had heart attacks. However, there's so many great natural ways to do this without running the risk of the side effects of being on a statin.
Absolutely.
So there's that.
Yeah.
So how are we doing? Any more that you want to go over?
I believe that was it for the questions.
Okay,
yeah.
I have a question for you. Burger King has introduced a brand new product. It is called the Satisfry. The Satisfry. And here's what the pitch is. The Satisfry contains, I think, 20% less calories than the regular fries.
Oh,
and they,
boy.
Now, so I mean, I looked into this, and they said what they're saying is it's a secret. It's a secret formula, because I could give away the secret formula for these addictive, ultra delicious fries.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're saying is they've come up with this new way so that the fries are a little less saturated with oil. So that as a result, what you're getting is a less fatty fry that they say preserve the same taste characteristics as their other fries that are like 350 calories per serving. And you say, what do you say?
I say, well, guess what? It doesn't really matter, because it's still a French fry.
Right.
It's still a French fry, folks.
Okay.
You're talking about glycation in the body. You're talking about, cooked carbohydrates that are causing us to rust.
Right.
And, all of that. So what
highly,
if there's less
highly,
fat?
Highly processed, mushy, potato starch.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Actually, I saw a satire on The Onion. What The Onion newspaper
yes,
is? They
yes,
had those
uh-huh.
goofy headlines, and they had this picture of a brand new fry product that it was steamed fries. They were steamed. And they had a picture of it, and it looked horrible because the fries were just all wilted and gloppy, and there was like little droplets of water and steam coming up. And they're steamed.
Mushy fries.
Right. And so the point is, if you eat, and this is actually how some people make their food choices. They say, well, I'm not going to eat any oils. I'm going to eat a very, very low fat. Is there any oil in that? Don't give me any oil. Don't fry that. But they eat so much starch.
Yes.
Don't put any, I want some sauteed vegetables, please, but just water saute them. Don't saute them mm-hmm. in any olive oil, because the olive oil is a fat. Is that a fool's paradise or what?
It's a complete fool's paradise, because it winds up being too many carbohydrates. People have to get away from the notion of being on a low-fat or ultra-low-fat diet. I learned that same lesson 15, 20 years ago myself. The pasta I ate didn't have a drop of olive oil in it or right. anything. And of course, I didn't butter the bagel. We all went through this. And then I went for my 6-mile jog, load up on my glycogen and so forth and so on.
Right, of course, for which you thought you had to really carbo load. So you
exactly.
Had,
that's
right.
what we were all doing. And, this idea has to die. It just really does. Our brains need a lot more fat, as we're all finding out, and Alzheimer's is being called type 3 diabetes, and we should let the people know if you want to learn how to Alzheimer's proof your brain, come to our lecture on Wednesday, October 23rd at 6 p.m. You just have to sign up for it. You sign up by calling our number, 212-779-1744.
And where will that be held?
That will be here at our offices on the third floor on Wednesday, October 23rd.
Okay,
Alzheimer's Proof Your Brain.
And we're located in?
At 776 6th Avenue between 26th and 27th Streets.
Okay, and it's a beautiful time of year, and it's a fun part of town, and so make an excursion into Manhattan. And we invite our listener, Eric, who is in Stuttgart. You know, the plane fares are very cheap, and there's a very favorable exchange rate. I understand that the euro is up vis-a-vis the dollar. The dollar is going into the crapper.
Yeah,
so
much for saving money.
Everybody walking around the streets in New York is speaking a foreign language, and you go into a department store, and they're all speaking Russian or Portuguese. or French or Italian. Nobody in New York can afford anything anymore, but the foreigners really love coming here.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, so that's going to be a good seminar. And we also, by the way, we recently interviewed Dr. David Perlmutter, who spoke on the subject of brain preservation. He's got a great new book called Grain Brain. And if you go to drhoffman.com/podcasts, you can scroll down. You can find that podcast. So let's reiterate once again. Layla, you're doing what I think is going to be an outstanding seminar, and the date is October 23rd at the Hoffman Center. And the subject is
Alzheimer's Proof Your Brain.
Alzheimer's Proof Your Brain, because you know we have things we can do to heart disease proof your heart. Even in conventional medicine, I mean, limited, but at least there are some things available. When it comes to this dread process by which people become cognitively impaired and dependent, we've got, 70 million baby boomers who are approaching the age where this is becoming a real prospect. And we need to do something to protect our brain. So you're going to tackle that subject. And the way to find out about it, 212-779-1744. Reserve your place for the upcoming Alzheimer's Proof Your Brain seminar at the Hoffman Center. And thanks very much for joining us, Layla.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.